for Radio Chaos 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, and antiwar.com. This is Antiwar Radio. Proving that it is more dangerous to be America's friend than its enemy, Saddam Hussein hung from a rope on December 30th. Here today to help us remember the U.S. government's history with Saddam Hussein is Robert Perry. He's an investigative reporter formerly with the Associated Press, Newsweek, and Bloomberg News, and now runs ConsortiumNews.com. He's the author of the books Trick or Treason, The October Surprise Mystery, Fooling America, How Washington Insiders Twist the Truth and Manufacture the Conventional Wisdom, Lost History, Contras, Cocaine, The Press, and Project Truth, and Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Welcome to Antiwar Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So the history of America's involvement, or the American government's involvement, with the regime of Saddam Hussein. Can we start back in 1958-59 with the overthrow of the British king?
Well, I think you can start back in those early days when Saddam Hussein was a rising figure in the Ba'ath Party and within the military intelligence structure of that country. He was involved in some of the violent acts, including alleged assassination attempts. And when he would get into trouble, he would often turn to U.S. intelligence to help provide him some protection. There were CIA officers who gave him safe haven after he was forced to leave Iraq at one point. And so he was always essentially someone who was considered, yes, a thug, but one who would work with the United States and other powerful outside forces. That was the backdrop to his rise to power. And when the Ba'ath Party finally took over, and then when Saddam Hussein worked his way to the top of that organization, he was a person who was used to dealing with powerful figures from around the region and around the world.
And during those various coups that took place between the fall of the British king and when Saddam Hussein finally came into power, is it right that the CIA was involved in, or basically taking the side of the side Saddam Hussein was on in all those various different cases?
Well, sometimes it's hard to figure the whole intelligence world out, and I must say I'm not as much an expert on that earlier period as I was on later, because I had to deal more with the 1980s and what happened subsequent to that. But I have talked to some of the CIA people who were involved in the region in those earlier days, and they had a very cynical view of what they were up to. They were often playing people against each other. There was a certain kind of strange bedfellow quality to much of it. Americans probably would be surprised to know that the CIA had very good relations with Nasser, President Nasser in Egypt. He was considered kind of a bit of a radical and someone who was a nationalist and a pan-Arabist. But he was also someone who had covertly good relations with some of the CIA people who were very strong figures in the U.S. intelligence and national security establishment of that time. People like Miles Copeland, for instance. I interviewed him before his death in England, and he would describe it both in his books and in the interview the way the U.S. Intelligence services would develop these relationships. And so sometimes Americans might have been surprised that the U.S. had ties to some of these sometimes ruthless, sometimes unsavory leaders. But it was how the CIA operated, and the CIA saw itself as protecting what it viewed as the national interests of America. Miles Copeland liked to talk about the CIA within the CIA, and what he meant by that was that there were this inner circle of CIA people who date back to its origins in the 40s who understood, in their view, what America was all about and what its real interests were. And they would act accordingly, even if it went against the stated open principles of the United States. They thought they were the ones who could make the judgment about what was in the best interests of America. And that kind of thinking, especially when you mix in the Middle East and the importance of oil to the U.S. economy, leads to this kind of relationship with sinister and unsavory characters who are able to wield power, people like Saddam Hussein.
Well, and the covert nature of it means that well, I guess, provides for the blowback. That's the definition of blowback, right? When there's consequences to policies that the American people don't understand.
Right. Well, blowback has a couple of meanings. One can be if false information is put into the public domain, say in Europe or somewhere, and then blows back into the United States, and that's happened at times. You know, for instance, there was the famous cases about the Soviets being involved in the assassination attempt against Pope John Paul II, when many in the agency understood that they'd been sort of doing black propaganda operations with it, with that information, and then it came back into the American political process.
And that's a rumor that still goes around. People still bring that up.
Right, but one of the reasons the CIA knew a lot of this was false was that the CIA had been planting it as black propaganda, false information, into the European media, into Eastern Europe. So there are times, so there's that kind of blowback. But there's also the sort of blowback, as you say, where the United States gets involved with someone for some maybe rather defined purpose, and it has consequences that later years that people don't anticipate. For instance, the United States, people probably would be shocked today to hear that the United States, back in the 1980s under Reagan and Bush, was actively supporting Osama bin Laden, that that Al-Qaeda, the people that organized Al-Qaeda were in some cases being helped and with their structure and their weapons and their money by the U.S. and by U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia. But that was because the U.S. was trying to use them to go after the Soviets in Afghanistan, and the consequences of that then blew back on the United States, most notably on September 11th, 2001. So yes, there are those two kinds of blowback.
Well, and you talk about the CIA and their covert actions in regards to Iraq, how basically it's this cynical, amoral policy that goes on in secret where oftentimes both sides of a conflict are being funded and armed by the United States at the very same time. You're actually famous for breaking many of the major stories of the Iran-Contra era. Everybody knows America was backing Saddam Hussein then. But, of course, we're backing Iran, who was at war against him at the very same time, right?
Right. I mean, there is that interesting history, which has never been fully explicated and may never be at this point, from that era of the, sort of starting in the late 70s. I've focused on this a lot in my writings in a consortiumnews.com website. But the key point to understand is that when you had the overthrow of the Shah by the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, and there was, of course, Shiite fundamentalism in Iran, and that set off a series of events and actions that a lot of folks don't want the American people probably ever to understand. And it includes the possibility, at least according to a document from Secretary of State Alexander Haig, that Jimmy Carter, as he grew more and more frustrated because the Iranians had seized 52 Americans as hostages after the revolution, that as Carter became more and more frustrated with that he may have given a green light to Saddam Hussein to invade Iran in September of 1980. Carter has denied these suggestions, but I was able to uncover a top-secret document which was basically talking points that Haig had prepared for briefing President Reagan in 1981. Haig had gone to the Middle East on his first trip and came back with words from then Prince Fahd, later King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, that the Saudis had conveyed this green light from Carter to Saddam Hussein to go after the Iranians. So, I mean, that sort of secret, it would obviously be embarrassing both to Jimmy Carter, but it's also the kind of thing that that the United States has not wanted focused on, because part of the justification for going after Saddam later was that he had invaded his neighbors, if you remember. But he seemed always to be at least working with at least his sense that he was doing what others wanted him to do. And whether Fahad was telling Haig the truth, I guess one will never know either. But this is a document that I was able to find which sheds light on this. So you have this. So you have, going back to this early period, this less than clear sense of what the United States wanted to happen, and whether Saddam was operating somewhat as this buffer for the Saudis and maybe the Americans concerned about the Persian Gulf oil fields, and sort of standing up to and blocking the expansionism of Iran. This is important history to know now, because we've now seen what happens when you remove Saddam Hussein and neutralize Iraq as a sort of Sunni buffer, if you will, against the pressures of the fairly wealthy and powerful Iranian state, which is still run by Shiite fundamentalists. What we now see is this expansion of Shiite power, which the Saudis had been very afraid of back in 1979 and 80. And oddly, George W. Bush was able to essentially facilitate by this this ouster of Hussein and the destruction of Iraq as any kind of Sunni military force that could stop this expansion. But if you knew the history, which apparently maybe George W. Bush didn't know, this would not have seemed so odd.
Well,
but the American people are systematically shielded from this sort of history, because a lot of it is dirty, and a lot of it would, even if known today, might lead to criminal charges against some of the people allegedly implicated in these activities.
Ah, well, and speaking of criminal charges, the famous picture of Donald Rumsfeld meeting with Saddam Hussein in 1953, I guess the conventional wisdom has it that that was when American support for Iraq and that war really started, but if this story about Jimmy Carter giving the green light back in 79 or 1980 is accurate, then America really was involved in Iraq's, as you say, containment of the Iranian Revolution from the very beginning.
Well, I think that's certainly, I mean, to some level that's true. I mean, I think green lights can be sort of in the eye of the beholder. I mean, I think one has to give Jimmy Carter a certain amount of leeway here. It's also possible that that the Saudis were passing on a message which they heard what they wanted to hear, let's say, because they wanted Saddam to act aggressively to protect them from this expansion of this Islamic fundamentalism.
Well, if I remember right from reading your article where you mentioned the Jimmy Carter green light there, wasn't there another source besides this Alexander Haig document?
Well, there have been Jimmy Carter responds to it actually in his memoirs, because it had been sort of floating around the Middle East, although it never really got much attention in the United States. And he reacts to it in his memoirs and said, well, you know, the Iranians there had been this suggestion that I had put Saddam up to it, and that's just silly, ridiculous, something like that. He doesn't really address it directly, and he's never, to my knowledge, directly addressed the Haig document, which we have posted on the internet. But it's certainly it's something where he should. Now, maybe he can effectively deny it. It's possible also that maybe one of his subordinates carried a message to the Saudis in a way that was ambiguous. It's possible that the Saudis exaggerated what they heard so they could get Saddam to move. But what's significant, though, is that it wasn't just a case, as it's now being presented, that Saddam Hussein was just this wild-eyed, crazed dictator who invaded his neighbors willy-nilly. In the case of the Iran case, the situation at least, that wasn't the way it happened. And indeed, there had been a number of border skirmishes between Iran and Iraq in the weeks and months prior to the all-out start of the war. So, you know, we get more propaganda than we get truth sometimes, and I think this is a case where there was an ambiguous situation that's never been clarified. The American press has never pushed these government officials to clarify this. It's just become this mushy history that we sort of live with these days, and often when there are sort of half-hearted investigations of these things, Congress or whoever's handling them doesn't want to really push the envelope, doesn't want to find the real bottom line truth. They'd rather work out some compromise where were no ones too upset. That's been sort of the record, at least recently, of congressional investigations. We end up with sort of a political truth, not a real truth. And all of that, I think, redounds badly to both American democracy, but also to our it allows the government to manipulate us when it wants us to get worked up and support wars or support some, you know, military buildup or any kind of thing of that sort. If we knew the full story, we might be less manipulable. And so we never seem to get the full story. And in fact, one of the odd things is that even though there's all this information and evidence, documentary evidence, as well as in some cases eyewitnesses, we're always being told these are conspiracy theories. And that was even the attack when people tried to dig into the history of the U.S. Support for Iraq in the 1980s, so-called Iraqgate scandal. Congressman Gonzalez was one of the leading figures in trying to find out what the Reagan-Bush administrations had done. But he was ridiculed as of an old fool and a conspiracy theorist. And when journalists tried to dig into this, they were called the same. And so people watching out for their careers tend to want to avoid those kinds of labels, and so they don't push very hard. And those who are more, those journalists or those members of Congress who are a little bit more amenable to just going with the flow, find that their careers advance and they make good money, and they don't, and so they don't really push too hard for the truth either. And that's been the real problem.
Right. And, of course, you know, if you just look at a little bit of history, it used to be that the mafia was a conspiracy theory. So sometimes just because people use that label, it doesn't mean that it's not really so.
Right. And of course, there are things, I think, that should be dismissed as conspiracy theories.
Sure.
But the point is, if there is real evidence, one has to get back to this case. And I come out of a very long journalistic career and background, you need evidence. You need to be able, and then you can evaluate the evidence. Sometimes evidence isn't entirely clear, like this, the Hague talking point, top secret talking point memo. You know, maybe it's possible Hague's not telling the truth. It's possible Faha's not telling the truth. It's possible there was some ambiguity that's been lost. But unless you have an aggressive effort to dig out the truth and put these people in situations where they have to talk about it, you're never going to get to anything close to the truth. And that's what we've tried to do. It's one of the main reasons we started ConsortiumNews.com was, you know, back 11 years ago, was to sort of collect a lot of this evidence and put it as much as we could in one place and in some context.
And now, if people want to see that Alexander Haig memo referring to Jimmy Carter's green light through Saudi Arabia for Iraq to invade Iran, they could find that at ConsortiumNews.com?
Sure, they can go to the homepage. And probably the fastest way is to just, it's in several places, but if they go to the Google search feature, they can go on and just, you know, put in Haig green light and the relevant stories and access to the document would pop up.
I'm Scott Horton, and this is Anti-War Radio. I'm talking with Robert Perry. He's runs ConsortiumNews.com and is the author of Secrecy and Privilege: Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. We're talking about the history of the American government's covert involvement in propping up the dictatorial regime of Saddam Hussein. Mr. Perry, in the 1980s, did the U.S. government approve or were they involved in the sale of chemical weapons to Iraq for the use against Iran?
Well, this is another one of those murky elements of the history. What we could say is clear based on various investigations and documents and witnesses who've come forward is that the United States essentially chose to back both sides in the Iran-Iraq war. This goes back to some of the thinking of then CIA Director William Casey, who thought it was kind of clever to pit the two sides against each other and then, you know, make money and build influence by providing them with various forms of military support. All of this, of course, was highly covert. Much of it was illegal. Much of it was done through third countries, where the United States had greater deniability, that it could set up an arms shipment or allow an arms shipment to go forward, maybe replenish those supplies or help turn a blind eye to what otherwise the U.S. would try to stop. So there was this sort of secret aspect to the foreign policy that that has never really been fully explicated. We have some pieces of evidence, though. For instance, there was an affidavit, a sworn affidavit, taken out by Howard Teicher, who was a National Security Council staff member for Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s. And he was one of their Middle East experts, and he had handled some of these matters and some of the documents. So he, in connection with a criminal case that was playing out in Miami in the mid-90s, he filed an affidavit for the defense, and he filed it in open court. It was very quickly classified, but it got out. And so it circulated some, and I was able to get a copy of it. It's also posted at consortiumnews.com. And in Teicher's affidavit, he describes the history of the Iraq program and how Ronald Reagan had decided in 82 that since Iran was gaining the upper hand and there was an effort to keep some balance in this conflict, the U.S. would tilt to Iraq for a while. And therefore, these secret programs were put in place, and a lot of it involved going through third countries to enable these shipments to move forward. One of the key arms dealers who was working with the U.S. was named Carlos Cardoen. He was based in Chile, and he was under the protection of the dictator of Chile, then Augusto Pinochet. And the U.S., of course, had very close relations with Pinochet through the CIA, going back to the origins of his government in 73. So Cardoen was the guy who was sort of putting together various arms packages for Saddam Hussein, and they would be shipped out. Now, according to Teicher's affidavit, he describes the role not only of William Casey, but of Casey's deputy, Robert Gates. Gates also had a hand in managing this, and he of course has since become now defense secretary. So Teicher describes much of this in his affidavit. There also, even before Teicher's affidavit, there were witnesses that I had developed when I was doing some projects for PBS. There were witnesses who'd been involved in these arms deals, one from the point of view of the Iraqis, an Iranian named Richard Babayan, who had served as one of the middlemen. He'd been a wealthy Iraqi who had been forced out after the revolution and joined forces with the Iraqis, and had become someone who was working with Cardoen and others in these arms deals. And there was an Israeli intelligence officer who had ended up in some legal trouble named Ari Ben Menashe, who also described the Israeli concerns. He had been involved with approaching CIA officials, including Gates. He had said in these interviews and later in a book he wrote to warn the CIA that these shipments were not just of bombs and other more conventional weapons, but they also were including chemicals and other biological agents that could be used in weapons of mass destruction. So the Israelis were protesting this behind the scenes because they were afraid they'd be at the receiving end of these weapons at some point. They weren't all that concerned, I suppose, about them being used against the Iranians, but they didn't want them turned against Israel. According to these accounts, Gates essentially tried to talk the Israelis out of being that worried or concerned. He denied that there was much going on, even though the Israelis were certain that it was. So we have these pieces of history. These pieces of evidence pointing to a direct or indirect U.S. role in Saddam obtaining his equipment. There also were European countries involved and companies involved. So you have a very mixed picture that when it began to come out, and a lot of it came out after the crisis over the first Gulf War, after Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait and the U.S. Tried to force him and ultimately forced him out of Kuwait. This history began to bubble to the surface then, because people started focusing on, well, how did Saddam get all this stuff? But it was pretty rapidly put under wraps. Congressman Gonzalez, who had led the fight in Congress, was attacked and ridiculed and discredited, mostly ignored by the major news media in the United States. There were other efforts to get at it, but never very fully formed. The then Bush administration, the first Bush administration, fought aggressively against any congressional investigation. And after the election in 92, the incoming Clinton people saw no real political gain in pursuing this. So they essentially joined in dropping it. And Congress did not pursue this investigation after Bill Clinton became president in 1993. It was seen as a gesture of bipartisanship to essentially sweep this history under the rug.
Which worked out really well for him.
Right. It was not only the wrong thing to do, it was the stupid thing to do, because by not forcing out the truth about what the Republicans had done and essentially freeing up the Republican defense mechanisms, their newspapers and talk radio and all the rest of it, which had been really set up almost to defend, which had been originally meant to defend Reagan and Bush from accusations of wrongdoing that they encountered, that whole apparatus could be swung around and used offensively against Bill Clinton, and was, to spread stories about his alleged scandals and blow out of proportion things like the White House travel office firings and things that we would have considered highly inconsequential during the Reagan-Bush years suddenly became major stories. And it led, ultimately, this whole pattern led to Clinton's impeachment and the trial in the Senate.
Well, now, I was only a kid in the 80s, but I guess my understanding is that it was basically an open secret that America was backing Iraq in throughout the 1980s, whereas the support for Iran was the big secret. Is that right or not?
Well, I think it's somewhat right, but it never was very well explained. It never was really focused on. It wasn't a big story. You might think it would have been, but it was known that the United States, that there was a tilt to Iraq, that Iraq was taken off the terrorist list at one point, things like that. But it wasn't something, even those of us who followed this, you wouldn't have been finding an awful lot in the newspapers of the day. I'm sure there were things, but it wasn't like a major story.
Well, now, another part of the understanding, I guess, is that America really backed Iraq, but the weapons that they sold to Iran, say the TOW missiles that they sold through Israel, that basically that was just old junk to get our hostages back or whatever, but that the material support for Iran never really amounted to much compared to the material support for Iraq. Is that right?
I'm not sure we know enough to give you that kind of quantitative measure, because I think we still know things almost that have sort of spilled out. If you look at the Iran side for a while, we now know that these weapons shipments to Iran began essentially immediately after Ronald Reagan took office. One of the interesting aspects of this is how much of this sort of spilled out. Of course, we didn't know until the fall of '86 that there had been any shipments to Iran. At least that we didn't really know. I guess there were indications, but in terms of actually having it be sort of verified and put out publicly. And that's when the admissions of the so-called Iran-Contra shipments were made. But and the focus then was from 84 to 86. And there were interesting questions in that period, because in 85 there had been no intelligence finding by Reagan. So there appeared to have been just violations of the Arms Export Control Act to allow these shipments to go through the Israelis. But as we investigated this more and more, some of us, anyway, tried to track back where this began, and the official story that it all began in sort of 84, 85 with some contacts between the Israelis and the Iranians and some Americans, that just didn't hold water. And so we began going back further, and we were able to discover, ultimately, with documents as well as with firsthand testimony, that the shipments actually began at least by early 81, possibly even in some form in late 1980. So you had, for instance,
so the arms shipments then were part of the October surprise deal?
Well, that apparently was the time frame. If you go to this interview we had with Assistant Secretary of State Nicholas Veliotis, Veliotis describes he handled the Middle East during the early 1980s, and he discusses there was a plane that was shot down. It was an Argentine plane that was carrying U.S. equipment, U.S. military equipment, by the Israelis to Iran, and it strayed over the Soviet Union, was shot down. So there was some obvious interest in some of this, and there was some press attention. And what Veliotis discovered in checking back was that this was part of an approved set of shipments that had been approved by the Reagan administration. And Veliotis said that some of this goes back to the 1980 campaign period, when the Israelis identified who would likely be in the next Republican presidency. So they began making those contacts, and these shipments then followed, according to Veliotis. And this was also supported by there was a memo that I was able to obtain that David Satterfield, who's now a fairly prominent foreign policy official in the Middle East, had written when he was then a young staff guy in the State Department. But he also describes that these shipments go back to 81. And so we now have this knowledge. It's sort of the hazy, half-confirmed, half-denied history that we live with. But there's strong evidence that the Reagan administration had given a green light or clearance or approval for the Israelis to begin these shipments to Iran, essentially right after Reagan took office.
And for those interested, you're actually the author of a book about the October Surprise, Trick or Treason, the October Surprise Mystery. I'll have to get that and put it next to Gary's sixth book on my shelf. Interesting story. I guess most people remember the day that Ronald Reagan took office, the Iranians coincidentally let all the hostages go.
Right. At that point, there were 52 Americans who had been held hostage, and this had essentially sunk Jimmy Carter's reelection bid. And it just, by coincidence, there was the one-year anniversary of the hostage taking was Election Day in 1980. So there was a lot of focus, a lot of media focus on the hostage problem and Carter's failure to solve it. And what had been a fairly close race sort of blew open to more or less a Reagan landslide. There were other factors that undermined Carter, obviously, but this was a big one. And this was the one that Reagan's campaign director, William Casey, had been most focused on. And that, which of course gave rise over time to the so-called October Surprise issue of whether or not the Reagan campaign had made illicit contacts with Iranians behind Carter's back, either to try to figure out what Carter was up to or make their own deal with the Iranians. And now, of course, there's evidence that tends to go both ways, although I think the preponderance of evidence now goes to support that the Republicans did make some kind of understanding with the Iranians before the election in 1980.
And now that understanding would be then to keep the hostages longer than they were going to, right?
Well, there's always the question of whether or not the Iranians would have ever released them to Jimmy Carter, and depends how you want to look at it. Either the hostage release was delayed, or which I've heard from some Republicans have said as well, what we were trying to do was get the earliest possible release, which would have been when Carter left. So it kind of depends how you want to look at it, but the idea that there was this secret relationship that had developed using the Israelis, mm-hmm. even at that early phase, I think has been largely established, but there's still, again, some haziness to it.
Right, because, again, Congress did not do their job and investigate it.
Well, Congress did investigate it, but when the evidence was really pouring in, this also happened in 1992, I was talking some few years ago with the chief counsel for the investigation, Larry Barcella, and Barcella had been someone who had put down this story, considered it a conspiracy theory, but in the time frame of December 92, a lot of new evidence began pouring into this investigative task force, indicating that the Republicans had struck this deal. And Barcella was so struck by the strength of this evidence that he went to the head of the task force, Congressman Lee Hamilton, and asked Hamilton to get an extension so they could review this evidence for another 3 or 4 months. And Hamilton refused. He wanted it just wrapped up. And that was sort of the feeling at that time, since Clinton was coming into office, there was a desire not to have bitter partisan fights, much like you've seen even today, this argument, which is, well, we have to be bipartisan, we don't want to seem vindictive, that will just undermine the Democratic domestic agenda. There are a lot of reasons why these things happen, but often it's hard to get at the truth, and it's painful. Sometimes it's easier to find an excuse to just let it go, and that's sort of what happened with that investigation, like the Iraqgate investigation, which was going on in a parallel fashion at that time.
I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm talking to Robert Perry from ConsortiumNews.com. Now, a few minutes back, sir, when you're talking about American support for Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War, you mentioned not just chemical weapons, but actually precursors for germ weapons as well. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, again, this is not something that was ever really fully explored. I think mostly we knew about we have known more about the chemical weapons, in that some of those that equipment allegedly came through this arms dealer in Chile. But there really, again, there has not been a full accounting of all this. And one of the great tragedies of what's happening in Iraq right now is that even though many of these documents are now in the possession of the U.S. government, there has not been an effort to exploit those documents to find out what the truth was about the 1980s. For instance, in 2004, there was a so-called DOFA report, which was the CIA report, which looked into whether or not Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction at the time of the U.S. invasion.
That was the one where they admitted that he hadn't had any even chemical weapons since 1991.
Right. DOFA concluded that basically everything that the Bush administration had said about this was dead wrong. However, he also included a section of this report which dealt with the history. And ironically, he spent a great deal of time exploiting these captured documents to show that in the 1990s, Saddam had been skimming off money from the Oil for Food program and using it for improper purposes, but not for building weapons of mass destruction, since he hadn't been doing that since Dofer concluded, since about 1991. So Dofer's report is sort of odd in that regard, because it focuses a lot on this money skimming in the 1990s when there was no WMD being made. Dofer does say that there was extensive development of WMD in the 80s, but he does not describe how that happened. He's silent when it comes to who was behind those shipments, how those shipments were arranged, who got paid. A very curious failure, it would seem to me, that if you're going to deal with this issue of how Saddam got his weapons of mass destruction, you'd want to look at the period when he actually was making them.
Well, and didn't Bush send a SWAT team to steal Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction report and to censor all the parts about how America helped before the war?
Well, I mean, there was that long report that Saddam had submitted to the UN, which I'm not sure if that has ever been made public. It's a good question. I'm not sure how it was ridiculed at the time as a lie, because Saddam was saying to the UN, this was of course in 2002, that he did not have any weapons of mass destruction. So that was effectively laughed out of the American media.
Of course, Scott Ritter says now that 12,000-page report was the most complete accounting of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs ever.
Right. It's a good question whether or not that remains secret. But many of these documents also got to the UN, because the UN was doing an investigation of the Oil for Food program under a former Fed Chairman Volcker, if you remember. And again, I talked to someone who was part of that, a source in that investigation, who wouldn't really tell me much in the way of substance, but said that that they did have documents about the weapons from Cardoen, the Chilean arms dealer, who was at the center of much of this this activity. But the peculiar thing is you have all these documents relating to the 1980s, which are being kept under lock and key. And the other, of course, immediate tragedy is that just yesterday, the genocide trial of Saddam Hussein's co-defendant, since he's no longer part of it, since he's been executed, played a tape of Saddam talking about his use of chemical weapons in the 1980s. If he hadn't been rushed to his execution on December 30th, conceivably he could have been asked in this trial, where did you get these weapons? Who helped you? Who aided and abetted in the genocide? But the answers to that might be very, very difficult for some powerful people in the United States.
And very difficult for him to say out loud with a snapped neck.
Right, he's been silenced. And I think it obviously everything about that was rather unusual, but in any case where you have someone who is maybe facing death but is on trial or is part of a trial, you don't execute witnesses before they've had a chance to testify in some other case. You know, the whole thing smacks of another sort of finality in the cover-up of what Saddam Hussein might have said if he ever had a full chance to present his side of the story.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you'd gone to The Hague, for instance, which is what happens to most dictators and tyrants after they're overthrown, he would have had a chance to present, and his lawyers would be able to present, without facing the danger they were facing in Iraq, present what really happened in as full a historical context as possible. But all that was cut short when Bush handed over Saddam to the Maliki executioners.
Well, we've talked about the friendship of America and the regime of Saddam Hussein and his execution, but how do we get from here to there? What happened that made Saddam Hussein, that changed Saddam Hussein from America's good friend in the region to our worst enemy? And I guess to be more specific, what exactly happened at the meeting with Ambassador April Glaspie and Saddam Hussein on July 25th, 1990? And did she, in fact, pass on carte blanche to Saddam Hussein that he could go ahead and invade Kuwait if he wanted to?
Well, I think we have to go back a little bit to this, to the Iran-Iraq War, which of course went on for 8 years. Now, based on what we know, Saddam Hussein felt that he had been essentially encouraged back in 1980, by the Saudis at least, to protect their interests, protect the interests of the Sunnis of the region by stopping the expansion of this Islamic fundamentalism, the Shia fundamentalism. There obviously were a lot of Shias in Iraq, and there are also many in Saudi Arabia. And many of them happen to live in the oil-rich areas. So there's a lot of interest in maintaining, protecting those oil fields from possible loss to Iranian expansion or some kind of secession by Shiites. So Saddam went to war with the Iranians and fought them for 8 years at heavy cost to his country, and both in manpower and money. Among those who were helping him, supporting him during this enterprise, were the Kuwaitis, who were clearly also near the front lines of a possible Iranian victory. After the war ends, finally in 1988, Saddam finds himself essentially bankrupt. His country is in serious financial trouble. The Kuwaitis, however, are not showing him much sympathy or much gratitude for his service in protecting their wealthy interests. They start demanding repayment of loans. They also are busy slant drilling into Iraqi oil fields and stealing Iraki oil. So Saddam starts getting more and more confrontational and threatening toward them. And they are acting in a fairly, his view, a very high-handed way. This is the point when he approaches the Americans again, because if you know his history, which is that he's always seen himself as kind of a, to some degree, an American ally, someone who does the bidding of the United States, going way back and continuing on through the 80s, He approaches Ambassador Glaspie and tries to get the U.S. Sense of U.S. policy on this, and she says that the U.S. takes no position on border disputes among Arab states, and this message is reinforced in other messages he's getting from the State Department, essentially a hands-off kind of view. Now, once again, not all this is clear either, but I would tend to think that the Bush 1 administration was not encouraging Saddam to essentially take over Kuwait. They may have understood that he might have wanted to deal with the border problems he was facing, but not necessarily take the whole country. Saddam, however, decides to take the whole country and sweeps in and takes Kuwait City and drives the al-Sabah family into a panic retreat. They flee to Saudi Arabia. Senior George Bush seems to be a little bit, at first, not sure what to do. He is then approached by Prime Minister Thatcher, who bucks him up and says, don't go wobbly. And Bush then gets out of his helicopter and walks over and pronounces that this will not stand. What happens after that is interesting, and this is another part of the history that's never been fully explored. I count some of this in Fooling America, but what happens next is that Saddam realizes that he's overreached, and he begins sending couriers, messengers, to the United States indicating that he is ready to withdraw. He's eager to have some kind of agreement where he'll get out. He's not determined to stay. But it becomes a point that Bush, that George Bush Sr., sees this as an opportunity to sort of assert what he was then calling the New World Order. And so from Saddam just being a guy we kind of worked with and tolerated and covered up for, we even, by the way, for a while were blaming the Iranians for some of the gas attacks that we're now blaming Saddam for, we suddenly became this, he became worse than Hitler. If you remember the kind of hyperbole that was then suddenly used, there were these propaganda hearings with the idea of whipping the American people up into hating this guy. There were the stories about Iraqi soldiers tearing babies from incubators in Kuwaiti hospitals and smashing them to the hard floor. Stories that turned out to be apocryphal, but were seized upon by Bush Sr. To rally the American people into kind of this rage about Saddam. And of course, the pundits on all the TV shows reflected how they're all the macho, tough guys, the Charlie Krauthammers and the Fred Barneses and the Mort Kondrakis were all stomping around, showing that they were tougher than anybody. So there was this hysteria that built up. And if you follow the history of this, and a lot of this I recount also in Consortium News in a section we have on Colin Powell called Behind Colin Powell's Legend, because we now know, based on what Powell has said in his memoirs, what Scowcroft has said, what Schwarzkopf, the commander of the U.S. forces in Persian Gulf, said, that even toward the end of this, toward right before the United States actually goes on the ground offensive, Saddam is still signaling that he's ready to withdraw. He wants to withdraw from Kuwait.
During the air war.
Even before the air war, and then after the air war, he renews this effort to get out. And he uses Gorbachev, the president of the Soviet Union, to convey this plan. And so the Russians put together a plan for the withdrawal of Iraqi troops from Kuwait. They'll leave their weapons behind, basically heavy weapons behind, and march out. And Schwarzkopf wants to take this deal. He thinks he has Colin Powell on his side. Colin Powell is back in Washington. He's now chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So Powell then goes to a meeting at the White House to sort of pass on the commanders in the field are ready to accept this deal. They don't really want to have a ground war. They don't want to see their men die. The Iraqis have been pounded pretty heavily from the air. It's been a bloody mess already. So Powell shows up at the Oval Office, and George Bush Sr. is pacing around saying how upset he is about this Russian peace deal. And he says, we don't want to screw Gorbachev because he's come a long way for us, but he wants a ground war. because it's seen as that'll be the crowning achievement. It will be something that will stir the American people. So instead of agreeing to what Gorbachev wants or what Schwarzkopf wanted, Powell offers a phony compromise where the Iraqis would be given 3 days or something ridiculous to get all their troops out. Otherwise, they'd be attacked. And a compromise
that was made to fail.
It was made to fail. And Bush loves it because it sort of creates this appearance that the U.S. is responding to the Soviets, but knows that it can't be done, and the ground war will proceed. And when Bush announces this on the lawn of the White House, Schwarzkopf and his generals back in Saudi Arabia see this and they say, okay, we're going to war, and they prepare for the final assault. Now, once they have their 100-hour war, which is pretty much a turkey shoot where a lot of Iraqis are slaughtered, Bush then wraps this up, and then he makes this remarkable comment. His first comments after the end of the 100 hours, he goes out and he says, "We've licked the Vietnam syndrome once and for all."
Mm-hmm.
And what that indicated, there's reporting on this as well. What that indicated was that the real focus of Bush and Cheney, who was then Defense Secretary, was not as much liberating Kuwait as liberating the American people from their hesitancy to engage in war overseas. And that had been a big strategic concern of the Reagan people going back to the early 80s. They wanted to sort of get the American people out of this so-called Vietnam syndrome. And they started us with Grenada, and then they moved up to, they had Panama. They did these different larger and larger conflicts, but were fairly easy conflicts. And Bush went ahead with the 100-hour war, the ground war, in part because he wanted the American people to have this cathartic joy of having won a ground war. And that's what he commented on immediately afterwards. We kicked the Vietnam syndrome once and for all. So we were essentially being prepared for future foreign adventures because it was so much fun. And people enjoyed all the parades after the troops came back from the Persian Gulf, and there was this huge fireworks display I went to in Washington with all kinds of fancy fireworks that seemed to explode like yellow ribbons and stuff. It was an amazing performance which essentially sealed the deal with the American people that war was fun.
Right, and now this is something that we see the War Party lamenting, that perhaps with Bush Jr.'s version of the Iraq invasion, that maybe the Vietnam syndrome is back and the American people will be hesitant to do this kind of thing again in the near future.
Right. But what happened with George Sr., he gets a lot of credit now for having the wisdom to stop and not march on to Baghdad. But if you remember the pundits at the time, you go back and read the transcripts from the McLaughlin group and these different places, the pundits were all screaming and yelling about what a coward Bush Sr. was for not having marched on up to Baghdad and seized all of Iraq and killed Saddam Hussein.
So there he killed all those people and he didn't even get the real glory.
Well, I mean, he did, but at least he understood that there were limits of what American power could probably do. And so he did stop and he collected his winnings off the table. Of course, the consequences for Iraq were grim. The fact that there were, of course, the UN sanctions, which were pretty effective. They got rid of the remaining weapons of mass destruction, or the chemical, biological weapons, and prevented Saddam from really reinstituting those. They're much more effective than anyone had thought, I guess, because they seem to have worked almost completely. And so we go through the 90s, where the Clinton people don't want to be seen as soft on Saddam, because he's now been so demonized. Even though he had been a friend of the Reagan-Bush administrations in the 80s, he's now worse than Hitler, and so there's no way to sort of soften the sanctions, even though some people think they were excessive and causing horrible suffering for the Iraqi people. They continue through the 90s, and that, of course, leads up to the emergence of George W. Bush, who wants to sort of finish off some unfinished family business. Here's a guy who'd gotten in his father's way, caused a lot of criticism of his father. Remember also, after 91, after the war ended, there was more and more focus on the Iraqgate scandal, which really plays out in the, it mostly plays out after the war is over, because there was sort of an agreement not to talk about it much as the war was in progress. But then afterwards, it gets more and more attention, and it undercuts the heroism of George H.W. Bush, because he is seen as a bit of a hypocrite. It's an important, not a major, but a significant element in the 1992 campaign,
mm-hmm.
that Bush is seen as someone who had covered up his relationship with Saddam and then went ahead and sort of stumbled the U.S. into this conflict. So the gleam is off the great victory, and Bush resents that deeply in 92. But after Clinton wins, the Democrats effectively sink the investigation. They do not want to proceed. Clinton has some flunky lawyers over at his Justice Department do a review of this history. They come out with a report, which comes out, I think it's in early 95, saying there was nothing to it, effectively, that there were no illegal shipments. But then there was in one of the sections of the report, it says, well, we went through the CIA's records and found nothing, but the CIA was hiding. We found out they were hiding some documents in a special compartment, but since they were hiding them from us, they couldn't have been important.
Right.
And they conclude that therefore it doesn't affect their conclusions. So in other words, the CIA was withholding highly sensitive documents relating to Iraq from them, but since, you know, they really didn't want to go, they did not want to make a fight over this by the mid-90s, so the history was essentially swept again under the rug. It was then only a couple weeks later that Teicher came out with his affidavit, which basically said it was all true, and more so.
Well, now that George Bush has spread the Iranian Revolution that Ronald Reagan had used Saddam Hussein to contain, they can't really just leave it at that, right? And having given the south of Iraq to Iran, now they have to bomb Iran so that it's okay that they gave the south of Iraq to Iran.
Well, there is a little bit of the Sorcerer's Apprentice quality going on here, I suppose, you know, where the apprentice who thinks he knows what he's doing starts conjuring up magic that he can't control and then does more and more to make it worse, trying to stop it.
Right, Mickey Mouse with the brooms, right?
Right, and when he starts chopping up the brooms, and they become smaller brooms. And there is a certain quality of that here, I suppose. And it's, you know, I think the future, the next couple of months, are dangerous times.
Well, and you reported at the end of December that Bush, Blair, and Olmert have been having this, you call it the round robin of meetings, that don't seem to have any real explanation to them except that these guys are preparing their last-ditch efforts to save their political legacy by expanding the war.
Right. Certainly that is now in play. Whether or not it happens, I don't know. And, you know, it's something I suppose things can always be called off. But I was hearing this, and others were hearing this, the idea that there'd be an attack on the Iranian nuclear program. Cy Hirsch wrote about it last spring in the New Yorkers. At that point, the U.S. was thinking about using nuclear bunker buster bombs to destroy the main uranium enrichment facility, which is deeply underground and deeply protected by in this powerful bunker, and that there would need to be that kind of nuclear explosion to destroy it. Hirsch reported that the Joint Chiefs of Staff were furious and outraged, horrified that the White House would be considering using nuclear weapons, but could not get this taken off the table. And only in late April, after his first story appeared, did the White House finally agree to remove the nuclear bombs off the table. But we now are hearing that it may just have been essentially delegated to the Israelis. And of course, in the interim, you had in the summer of 2006, and I was told that there had been a meeting between Bush and Prime Minister Olmert of Israel in May at the White House 2006, where they discussed their future plans, and among them was to sort of hit back at this expanding Shiite power from extending from Iran, ironically now through Iraq, through Syria, to Hezbollah in South Lebanon, that there'd be this, and there was essentially a pretext, was the war waiting for a pretext. And the pretext occurs when there are these, you know, these tit-for-tat kind of border problems, and first Hamas captures an Israeli soldier, and that leads to a Israeli attack in Gaza, and then that sort of that replays on the border of Lebanon, where Hezbollah captures a couple of Israelis, and all hell breaks loose.
And then America was trying to get Israel to go ahead and expand the war to Syria at that
right.
point.
You know, originally when that started, I was being told, oh, this will just last a couple of days, and I was hearing from other sources though, no, the U.S. wanted this to go forward, that it was not something they were going to cut off, and they didn't cut off. It went on for 34 days. I was also told initially by a source I didn't believe, frankly, that that the U.S. was encouraging Israel to take out Syria, to go after the Syrian government. And so I had this in my sort of notes, but then you know, the Jerusalem Post reports it, that the U.S. has been sort of giving Israel encouragement to expand the war to Syria, which Israel did not do. They did buzz the presidential palace with their aircraft, but they never actually attacked. Since then, more information has come out about this secret, these secret messages being passed back and forth. But the Israelis failed in their operation largely. They were after 34 days of a lot of killing, withdrew their forces. But that hasn't stopped their concern about what's going to happen with Iran, and Olmert has described the Iranian nuclear program as an existential threat to Israel. And I've been hearing that the Israelis were planning to, with Bush's encouragement, to go after the Iranians. Just last weekend, the Sunday Times of London reported a fairly detailed account of Israel's preparations for this bombing raid, including, again, the expected use of tactical nuclear weapons to take out this bunker of which is being used to protect the nuclear enrichment in Iran. So,
and the National Intelligence Director Nick Raponte has now been forced out and replaced with a yes man too.
And if you were to assume that these accounts are accurate, that this is the drift that Bush is taking and Omer is taking, you would. A lot of what's happened in the last few days, you would say, well, that kind of fits. I mean, you would say, here's Negroponte, who angered the neoconservatives last year when he came out publicly and said that U.S. intelligence had concluded that that Iran could not get a nuclear bomb until next decade, probably at the earliest. And that assumes they can do a lot of things they don't seem capable of doing. So instead of hyping the danger, he kind of tamped down the fears about it. He's been removed. The U.S. commanders in Iraq, who didn't understand why on earth Bush wanted to send in 20,000 additional troops to sort of do the same stuff that they've been doing for 3 years now, they were removed. Abizaid and Casey, Admiral Fallon, an admiral, a Navy admiral, was then put in replacing Abizaid, even though presumably he'd be overseeing two ground wars, one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
There are, of course, Bush has also dispatched two aircraft carrier attack groups to Iran. So it might make more sense to have Fallon in there if you were thinking about using your sea power more integral way to this to these whatever happening in the Middle East. So you have a number of ominous steps and ominous pieces of information coming out. Now, whether or not one goes through with it, I don't know. I did have a source say that there's a subtext to the 20,000 additional troops, which are not considered likely to really change the outcome of the Iraq war, but if there were, let's say there were an attack on Iran, and if the Shiites in Iraq rose up against the Americans as retaliation, it might make some sense to have additional combat forces to protect the Green Zone and other key installations.
And the supply lines.
Right, so you don't want to be drawing down your troops, let's say, if suddenly there's an uprising across Iraq. So there's a lot of ominous signs. Now, whether there's a decision made or whether there's just maybe this is a certain amount of bluffing to scare the Iranians, there are a lot of possibilities, and I can't really sort through them. I don't have that level of knowledge, but certainly there are reasons to be concerned.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. We're already over time.
Yep.
Thank you very much for coming on the show today.
You're very welcome.
Robert Perry, his website is consortiumnews.com, and his most recent book is Secrecy and Privilege, Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Thanks a lot again for your time.
Thank you.
You know, they find out Bush has been selling weapons to Iraq since whenever, and we knew that. I knew that during the Persian Gulf War. Those intelligence reports would come in. Iraq, incredible weapons. Incredible weapons. How do y'all know that? Well, we looked at the receipt. But as soon as that check clears, we're going in. What time's the bank open? 8? We're going in at 9.